You get dickheads in any society.
I never said that I thought it would be bad.
Are you high now?
Yeah.
Hey, Sarah McPhee with you. Today on Hack, you'll meet the director of the new TV show, The Handmaid's Tale.
Fertility is a gift directly from God. He left you intact for a biblical purpose.
It shows a scary world where environmental pollution has devastated America, and the only women who are still fertile are forced to be sex slaves. You'll hear how The Handmaid's Tale has inspired protesters across the US and find out what a climate-challenged future will mean for all of us. First, a bit of history on The Handmaid's Tale.
I had another name, but it's forbidden now.
The Handmaid's Tale was written by the Canadian author Margaret Atwood in 1985. It's the story of a woman who's had her rights taken away from her. She lives in America in the near future, but it's now called Gilead, and it's run by puritanical religious leaders who control everything.
I was asleep before. That's how we let it happen.
In Gilead, women are separated into categories. The barren wives of ruling men wear blue, and handmaids wear red. The handmaids are Gilead's last remaining fertile women, and they're forced to have babies for the rulers and their wives.
I expect you know the rules.
Yes, ma'am.
Margaret Atwood wrote the book in the 80s, at a time when the religious right was taking off in America. She imagined what would happen if the group got their way.
Do you now look back and think, oh, well, I was a bit sort of too worried. I got a bit carried away there, or not?
If you look at state by state, some of the laws they're putting in right now, yeah, I wasn't quite worried enough.
The author said she was also inspired by the treatment of women in other countries, including Muslim countries. In Gilead, women aren't allowed to read books, listen to music, or even share their feelings with other people. Atwood wrote the book in West Berlin when the wall was still up. She's since written that she'd experienced the wariness and the feeling of being spied on and channeled that into her story.
Under his eye.
Under his eye.
She also said that because she was born in 1939, she was well aware from World War II that established orders can vanish overnight. It can't happen here, can't be depended on, she's written since. And if you Google The Handmaid's Tale, countless articles asking, could it come true, will appear.
It's about 2 miles north. You said someone's going to meet us. All right, go with Mommy.
This year's TV adaptation starts with the main character, whose name is June, trying to escape with her child and partner. Her husband is shot and her child taken, and she's captured to become a handmaid.
No,
it happens at the very start, so it's not too much of a spoiler.
What's her name? I don't know her name, do you?
Over the next few episodes, we see snippets of June's old life, one that looks familiar to us in 2017, and one that's a world away from her new reality in Gilead.
You girls will serve the leaders of the faithful and their barren wives. You will bear children for them.
As the story unfolds, we learn that a threat of terrorism was used to justify a slow degradation of people's freedoms until the Constitution was trashed and martial law was established.
We didn't wake up then either. Now I'm awake.
Suddenly, women can't access their own bank accounts or go to work, and they rely on their male friends and partners to even walk down the street. After failed protests, we see the end result. A totalitarian regime where women have lost all their power. The environment's trashed and people in Gilead are living with the consequences, including limited food.
We should get some oranges before they're all out.
And fertility problems.
Fertility is a gift directly from God.
The message is pay attention. Your rights can easily disappear without you even realising. You're listening to Hack. I'm Sarah McPhee, and we're taking an in-depth look at the classic story, The Handmaid's Tale. And if you've read the book or you've been watching the TV show that's just come out, let me know. What did you get out of it? Do you think it could become reality, or is it way too removed from our lives? 0439 75 is the number to text me on, or you can give me a call, 1300 055 36. Grace in Kenshurst, you say, The Handmaid's Tale is phenomenal, such an intense, interesting and unnervingly familiar tale. Fantastic work. And Maddie from the Central Coast, you say, I had to read The Handmaid's Tale for school. Real weird and graphic, but I'm keen to watch the series, though there have been plenty of books which follow similar plots. It's not a super unusual storyline. Well, with us is Reed Morano. She's the director of The Handmaid's Tale. Reed, thanks so much for being here. What drew you to the story?
Well, you know, I read the book when I was in college, and I found it fascinating because of the way that the story is told, and just Margaret Atwood's writing is so visceral and at times very profound. And it's like, what do you do when you become a prisoner? And in a weird way, you sort of saw it coming, and you basically almost let it happen to yourself. And that's sort of, to me, what I thought was fascinating about The Handmaid's Tale. You know, another thing I find really interesting about Margaret is that she calls it speculative fiction, not science fiction, because it's about this could happen, or, you know, it's not totally made up. And she makes a point of saying that everything that happens in The Handmaid's Tale has happened or is currently happening somewhere in the world right now. And so in America, we're very sheltered, you know, because we have all these rights and people take it for granted. And I know I'm one of those people, and I feel like I'm sheltered. And so when I like to try to put myself as a storyteller into a scenario where I have to imagine something that is just totally bananas to me. And then how do you make I like the challenge of the idea of making the audience feel something and be, you know, affected by it. And maybe it changes their view on things.
Yeah. And as you say, Margaret Atwood said that she drew on things that have already happened. She didn't want to create new scenarios and be accused of making human beings more deplorable than they already are. What did you kind of take from the story, and what's it left you thinking about the nature of humanity, that these things have all happened?
I mean, anytime you're in a situation in that story, you have to force yourself to feel what that character's feeling. And I think it's frightening. And I guess in weird ways, I'm not surprised that this is, you know, happening in other parts of the world. But at the same time, I'm horrified. So it's like, I don't know it's possible to be simultaneously not surprised, but also completely, like, shocked that in this day and age that this could still be happening.
And in the third episode, which you directed, we see the kind of transition between a world that we might recognize, where the main character's going to work and, you know, living her life, hanging out with her friend and her partner, and then we see the transition as military take over and kind of command their life. And that started with a threat of terrorism that was kind of sold to the public, and they accepted their rights being taken away. They accepted martial law, and then suddenly they look up and it's too late. Is The Handmaid's Tale a warning to people at this point in history?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, initially when we started making it, I felt like it was obviously an amazing creative opportunity and the ultimate POV, psychological POV story. But I also felt like this is an opportunity to show people what's happening elsewhere and make them maybe heighten some awareness and maybe make people appreciate what they have. And I think now what was strange about it is going through the process of making it, and during the summer while we were shooting it, and was during the campaign, and then finally the election in America happened. And when I watched the assemblies of the footage, it just hit a deeper level emotionally. And in the weeks that followed, while I was editing those episodes, there were different things that were happening, at least in America, that were on a daily basis almost. I felt that there were laws being undone, and it was really frightening. There's a laziness, at least in America, and I'm part of it. I'm not accepting myself from that rule, but I was shooting in Toronto, and I went through a lot of hoops to get an absentee ballot to vote in my country. And, you know, to find out after the fact that 50% of the country didn't really vote. So I think it is a warning, and it's a warning for people to get their, you know, to not keep thinking that the other person is going to take care of it, or the other guy is going to take care of it. You know, it's like people go online and they sign petitions to, you know, to make themselves heard. And it's like, I hate to say it, but an online petition really doesn't do anything. So, yeah, it's a warning.
You're listening to Reed Morano. She's the director of The Handmaid's Tale. On the text line, Mitsuko from Avalon, you say, I have to be in the right frame of mind and prepare to watch it each time. That's exactly the same for me as well. And someone else says, the way our politicians are using terrorism as a smokescreen really shows that it can erode all our rights quite easily. And Rishi in Melbourne, you don't think that it could happen here in Australia?
No, I don't think the dystopian future Margaret Atwood paints in The Handmaid's Tale is possible in Australia, because we, the Australian public, are far too progressive and far too strong to allow something like this to happen.
We've heard Reed say that she thinks that there's a kind of laziness in the American population where people don't exercise their democratic rights. Do you think we're different here?
I do think we're different because we have the mandatory necessity to vote. We do, as a people, care a bit more about each other because we have a smaller nation, first of all, but also a nation that is more democratic in that sense because we are forced to have a say.
What impact did the film or even the book have on you?
The book was quite profound. Atwood's values, which she talks about through the novel, is quite strong. And it is true that we shouldn't take our rights for granted. And we as a people need to band together and make sure if something like this was to happen, which I don't think would happen, we should fight it.
Rishi, thanks so much for your insights. On the text line, Lily says, women's rights are moving forward, not backward, and I believe our universal voice will only become stronger. In that sense, I don't think it's possible. And someone else says, shades of Trump. Well, as you just heard, Margaret Atwood has famously said that everything that happens to women in Gilead has already happened at some point in time. And as Joe Lauder reports, a lot of it's still happening to women in some parts of the world.
Birth control pills. Morning after pills. Murdering babies. Just so they could have their orgies.
The Handmaid's Tale has really struck a chord with people in 2017. Even before the TV show came out, sales of the book went soaring after the election of Donald Trump in America, and millions of women hit the streets at the beginning of the year.
This was the scene in the nation's capital. Millions joining rallies in major cities and small towns, both here and around the world.
President Trump has reinstated the controversial global gag rule.
One of Donald Trump's very first acts as president was to bring back a law that bans U.S. funding from going to any aid groups that give sex education that includes teaching about abortion.
No American development money can be used to fund abortions. It's been that way for many, many years under something called the Helms Amendment. This Mexico policy goes further than that and actually restricts funding to organisations that mention abortion as part of sexual health education.
That's Holly Crockett from Plan International Australia, an aid organisation that focuses on children and especially girls. In America, women have been dressing up as handmaids in striking long red robes and white bonnets shielding their faces to protest against a number of bills that would restrict women's access to abortions.
A group of women turned out to the Texas State Capitol building on Tuesday wearing the red cloaks and white bonnets of the show's handmaids.
Yeah, for a lot of women in the world, The Handmaid's Tale is not a fable, it's a reality.
An example of that is Saudi Arabia, where women are banned from driving. They have to wear head-to-toe black coverings in public and need permission from a man to study, travel, or marry.
She doesn't belong to you.
That's right.
No, 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 she isn't your property and she doesn't need you to take care of her.
Only last week, a Saudi woman was arrested for wearing a miniskirt in a video that went viral. Mona El-Tahawi is a feminist writer and wrote the book Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution.
The use of women's bodies is the canvas upon which we signal our surrender to conservatism and patriarchy is very much a lived reality.
On the BBC World Service, Mona highlighted the similarities between Gilead and Saudi Arabia, where she lived as a teenager.
Those lines about enforced modesty in Gilead are especially chilling for me as a Muslim woman who has battled what I call modesty culture in the here and now.
Holly Crockett from Plan International Australia says women and girls are often the poorest of the poorest in developing countries, and they want to focus on empowering women and girls.
So that girls and women know their rights in terms of being able to choose when they have sex, who they have sex with, and whether or not they become pregnant. But we also want to challenge some of the conservatism that says that women don't have control over their own bodies.
In The Handmaid's Tale, there's a scene where the women find out that they've been cut off from their bank accounts.
Sounds like they just froze any account with an F on it instead of an M. Alyssa heard there's a new law. Women can't own property anymore.
Wait, what?
In parts of Africa, in parts of the Middle East, women can't inherit property. They may or may not have access to their own bank accounts, but they may or may not also be able to control money that they do have in bank accounts. It limits people because it limits choice.
In Gilead, women are banned from reading or writing because education is seen as dangerous.
Back then, did you ever imagine a society like this? A society in which women can no longer read your book. Or anything else.
It's a tool that's used around the world to oppress women, including by the Taliban. Remember schoolgirl Malala Yousafzai? She campaigned for the right for girls to go to school in her Taliban-controlled Pakistan and was shot for it.
I said to myself that, Malala, now you need to work for education of girls.
If you think about all the things you couldn't do if you couldn't read or write, education is really as close to a silver bullet as we have in terms of bringing women and girls, increasing their status, increasing their economic choices, broadening their horizons.
Hack on Triple J. Holly Crockett from Plan International Australia ending Joe Lauder's report. On the text line, Mel from Shepparton, you say, I can't help but think of Afghanistan and Iraq when the Taliban and ISIS came into power. This might make people open their ears to refugees more. And Jax from Kingswood, you say, I think we would be naive to think it would never happen. Daniel in Brisbane, you think it could happen in America?
It's a bit crazy to me, to be honest, to be listening to you in Australia now, but yes, it's absolutely insane to think that none of these things could happen here in this country now. Because you look at so many places all over the world it's happened, and they've exactly what they said, blamed it on terrorism or blamed it on anti-government rebel groups or whatever it is. But I would just really, really plead to everyone in Australia just not to follow in America's footsteps in the way that they're really letting things that should have been jokes become reality. And now,
what kind of things are you worried about in America?
Oh, I mean, realistically, if there was one or two big things that happened, they could immediately put in all sorts of times that you have
martial law, for example.
Well, yeah, martial law. But I mean, even things that are just pre-martial law, like curfews that you have to be in by a certain time. All of these things are very real worries that a lot of people in America are having right now. And before Donald Trump, it was kind of this joke of he's running for president and everything like that. But now it's actually real and it's happening there. So.
Well, Daniel, I guess, I mean, there is a huge difference between the world of The Handmaid's Tale and the America that exists today. But thanks for the warning and thanks for the call.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
You're on Hack with me, Sarah McVee, and also with us is Reed Morano. She's the director of the new TV show The Handmaid's Tale, which is based on a book by Margaret Atwood. Reed, women have been going to protests in America dressed as the handmaids from your show. How does it feel to be a woman in America right now?
I mean, I think women in America feel that their rights are being infringed on a little bit without doing that thing that, you know, I sometimes feel we do in America, which is like, oh, poor us. You know, it's like, no, it's not. It's not poor us. But there is a moment right now that is happening that is a bit worrisome because I think everybody's been so complacent because, like I said, we've been very lucky in America. We worked really hard for women's rights and, you know, we finally got to a place where we are, you know, we're in a great place with them. And then now there are a lot of different states that are taking matters into their own hands, so to speak, and they're making up their own rules. And, you know, if they're able to get an abortion safely or if they're able to even make that choice, things are starting to go backwards a little bit. You know, it's all sort of happening one thing after another. And I think people are speaking up. Women are speaking up. And there is a sort of banding together of not just women, but also men who are trying to preserve these things that we've worked really hard for that now seem to be in a very fragile position.
Elizabeth Moss, who's the star of the show, said in an interview, now is not really a time to stand in the middle. You've got to pick a side. And I guess that's kind of what you're alluding to as well. Do you feel like there's been a period of apathy followed by now a re-engagement in politics as people realise that rights are precarious?
Absolutely. I mean, I think like, I mean, just to even speak for myself, you know, it's like I was part of the problem. And, you know, like I don't pay a lot of attention to politics because I think I felt sort of secure in the past about, you know, our last president. And, you know, there were definitely some things that didn't go 100% right, and that I disagreed with. But I felt like for the most part that the person steering the ship was similar, you know, had similar views. And, you know, now people are sort of perking up to the fact that, like, oh, wait a minute, like, there are some really insane things that are happening and bizarre things. And who are we in the hands of right now? Are those people the best people to be making the decisions for us? And do we even share those views? And I would say that the majority of Americans don't. But I do think that the majority of Americans didn't realize that they were going to have to wake up and all of a sudden get active, because a lot can happen in 4 years.
What other parts of the world are represented in the storyline in the world of Gilead?
It's a lot about the past, you know. I mean, but I have to say it's the thing that comes to my mind mostly is the Muslim countries as far as current times. But you could sort of trace everything that's happened in Handmaid's Tale to probably nearly every country in the past. You know, even in America in colonial times, you know, the Salem witch trials, it kind of represents a lot of, it represents much of the world at one time or another. And, you know, just like Margaret said, that's where she got it from. She got it from history and she got it from present day, from other countries. And I just think it's really fascinating for a storyteller to take something and twist it into what appears to be a new story, but it's really been going on since the beginning of time.
Well, it's an absolutely incredible show. I would highly recommend it to anyone. But what do you hope as the director, what do you hope people get out of it from watching The Handmaid's Tale?
You know, I mean, I think on a larger level, I hope that they think about how it relates to their life and the world that they live in and their rights and their government. You know, that's probably the biggest thing that would come out of it. And I think that creatively pushes, you know, maybe we can hope that it will keep pushing in that direction. I think TV is really, you know, pushing the boundaries as far as something they can put a label on.
Absolutely. Reid, thanks so much for speaking to us on Hack.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hack on Triple J with Sarah McVee.
That was Reid Morano. She's the director of The Handmaid's Tale. And if you want to watch it, you can check it out on SBS On Demand. It's all there. It's all free. I'm Sarah McVee, filling in for Tom Tilley all this week. And on the text line, Pete Inouye, you're responding to the could this happen question. And you say, this time last year, we didn't think Trump was possible. And someone else says, the TV show completely ignores the issue of race, which is huge in the US right now. This TV show is an example of white feminism, and it chooses to ignore this aspect. And Levi, you say, I've read the book and I thought it was absolutely amazing.
Hack. They made such a mess of everything.
On Triple J.
They filled the air with chemicals and radiation and poison.
With Sarah McVee.
Well, as we've heard, The Handmaid's Tale is set at a time where environmental disaster has impacted everything from how much food is available to the security situation and even women's fertility. And to tell us how realistic that all is, Luke Kemp is here. He's a lecturer in climate and environmental policy at the ANU in Canberra. Luke, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure, Sarah.
In the TV show, they're talking about how lucky they are to be able to buy oranges. Are we likely to see food shortages like that?
In some certain crops and foods, due to climate change and other ecological impacts, yes. So, for example, cocoa and coffee, two of my more preferred things in the world, chocolate and coffee, could become much more scarce in the future, depending upon how the impacts of climate change play out and what level of warming we're looking at. Avocados are another thing that could be impacted. And that's because we've a changing climate, you're going to see both precipitation, so rainfall patterns change. You're going to see different areas opening up for crops, but a lot also becoming less viable for growing different kinds of crops. And additionally, because of extreme weather events, you're going to find that some crops in some years are just going to be wiped out. We have a good example of that with Cyclone Yasi, which devastated both avocado and banana crops in Australia and obviously led to most of us relying upon eating lolly bananas rather than the real thing.
Yeah, and you've talked about, I guess, some treats there, but what about like proper big-time food shortages where we start to actually worry about who gets fed in countries where that's not currently a problem?
Well, let's not underestimate the importance of coffee and chocolate, but but apart from that, the major grains that we rely upon, so corn, wheat, etc., are grown in a couple of key areas in the world. And there's some very worrying potential impacts in the future here. So one is drought increasing in what's known as the food bowl in the US, where a huge amount of corn is grown, for example. If you have increasing drought and water stress there, you're going to see prices skyrocket. We saw back a few years ago that due to wildfires that were in part attributed to climate change, the price of wheat increased because of these fires rippling across Russia. And similarly, we've got some modelling suggesting that in the later stages of this century, so much further into the future, you could see the monsoonal patterns failing once every 5 years, roughly. And of course, millions and millions of people rely upon the monsoonal patterns to feed them, particularly for rice crops. So it does depend upon the temperature change. If you're looking at 4 to 5 degrees, that's where things start to get really drastic, particularly in the longer term. In the shorter term, it's unlikely going to see any kind of catastrophic impacts. But that being said, the tipping points of climate change are not very well studied. So it's still a grey area in terms of how drastic this could become and how quickly.
Melissa, in Brisbane, you're worried about food being impacted by climate change?
Yeah, well, I definitely don't want to live without avocados, coffee or chocolate.
Shocking, shocking. Are you worried about actually being able to eat, though?
Eventually, potentially, yes, but like in the immediate future, no. But I think that we do need to be taking steps now. I'm an advocate for, you know, making sure you're looking after your recycling and living as sustainably as possible so that you're doing your part on a personal level. But I think that more needs to be done at a government level, investing in cleaner technologies and, you know, wind and solar and all of that. And, you know, why don't we put solar panels under roads and start powering our city from our roads?
So many big ideas there, Melissa. we're going to stick to looking at how the environment is going to impact our future. And Luke, one point you have made to me is that we do still have actually an oversupply of food. It's the distribution of food that's an issue. But moving on, could industrial pollution impact our fertility?
Potentially, I think to the degree that is depicted in The Handmaid's Tale, probably not. So we do have some weak linkages shown through research between industrial pollutants and, well, things like genetic defects as well as infertility. So we know, for example, across the 20th and 21st century that male fertility in particular has been declining. It varies across nations and exposure, but that seems to be at least weakly partially linked to some certain industrial pollutants. We also have, of course, anecdotal evidence and some particular cases in areas where communities who have been situated close to an industrial pollutant source have had increased genetic mutations and defects which have impacted fertility. But to be honest, the idea that we're going to go from these kind of weak linkages and, you know, small-scale cases to all of a sudden 50% or more of the population becoming infertile seems highly unlikely. If you're looking at the most likely or problematic things in the future when it comes to ecological pressures, it's not infertility. It's, once again, looking more towards things like food, for example. I mean, I'm much more worried about the collapse of fishing stocks than I'm about infertility.
Hey, Luke, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
All good. My pleasure.
That was Luke Kemp. He's a lecturer in climate and environmental policy at the Australian National University, and he's telling us about how we can expect the world to change as a result of changes in the environment. And we do actually have some breaking news. Northern Australian Minister Matt Canavan has quit cabinet following doubts over his citizenship. His mother has Italian ancestry, and under the Constitution, dual citizens aren't allowed to sit in the Australian Parliament. Senator Canavan is due to hold a media conference in Brisbane shortly, and this is coming after Greens Senators Larissa Waters and Scott Ludlam had to resign over their dual citizenships. That's all we've got time for on the show today.
Hack
on Triple J.